right, well, Tom threatened you to make you stay awake, all but ensuring that you're going to fall asleep now. And I have nothing to hold over your head. I'm not going to be here tomorrow. All I can do, I guess, is just ask for your attention. Let's go to Lamentations chapter 3. I do certainly want to thank the church for all your hospitality and for the cards and the prayers and the bags that you gave us. I think my children will probably come down from that high maybe about Thursday. So we really appreciate that. That'll be a great ride home. But we do appreciate it. We've been blessed to be here, our first time here. Very thankful for that. I appreciate your pastor very much, the more that I've gotten to know him. And I know most people don't say that have gotten to know him. So I'm going to say that, but I've come to appreciate him more. He has his quirks, but I suppose we all do. All right, so let's go to Lamentations chapter 3. The title of this message is simply going to be Restoration. Lamentations chapter 3, and we're going to be looking at this section in the middle of this book. We'll begin reading here with verse number 19. Remembering mine affliction and my misery, the wormwood and the gall, my soul hath them still in remembrance and is humbled in me. This I recall to my mind, therefore have I hope. It is of the Lord's mercies that we are not consumed, because his compassions fail not. They are new every morning. Great is thy faithfulness. The Lord is my portion, saith my soul. Therefore will I hope in him. The Lord is good unto them that wait for him, to the soul that seeketh him. It is good that a man should both hope and quietly wait for the salvation of the Lord. It is good for a man that he bear the yoke in his youth. He sitteth alone and keepeth silence because he hath borne it upon him. He putteth his mouth in the dust, if so be there may be hope. He giveth his cheek to him that smiteth him. He is filled full with reproach. For the Lord will not cast off forever. But though he calls grief, yet will he have compassion according to the multitude of his mercies. For he doth not afflict willingly, nor grieve the children of men, to crush under his feet all the prisoners of the earth, to turn aside the right of a man before the face of the Most High, to subvert a man in his cause, the Lord approveth not. Who is he that saith, and it cometh to pass when the Lord commandeth it not? Out of the mouth of the Most High proceedeth not evil and good? Wherefore doth a living man complain, a man, for the punishment of his sins? After his wife died at age 45 in 1960 from bone cancer, C.S. Lewis began writing in notebooks and trying to work through the miserable pain and grief that he was experiencing. Those writings would go on to be published in a book entitled A Grief Observed. Lewis confesses early on in that book that he didn't want to accept that nothing could be done with suffering except to suffer it. He just didn't want to accept that the misery and the grief and the sorrow that he was enduring, but he would just have to simply let it run its course. He wrote to try to get out of the pain, to try and to discover, as he said, some device that would make pain to not be pain. And he figured if nothing else, he would eventually run out of notebooks. He later described his efforts at trying to make a map of sorrow, as if making a map would enable him to find a way out. He discovered that grief turns out to be a process. And he wrote, "It needs not a map, but a history. Suffering has to be suffered until it is past. There is no way to simply make pain not be pain. That is true about suffering. And maybe that doesn't sound very hopeful or very helpful. But understand that suffering that has no point or no end is truly hopeless. If there's no point to the suffering that we endure, if there's no end to that suffering, and if there truly is no better day that there is to come after the suffering has passed, then we are of all men most miserable. That would make the world seem to be, as Richard Dawkins wrote of it in his book, River Out of Eden, he wrote, "The total amount of suffering per year in the natural world is beyond all decent contemplation. During the minute that it takes me to compose this sentence, thousands of animals are being eaten alive. Many others are running for their lives, whimpering with fear. Others are slowly being devoured from within by rasping parasites. Thousands of all kinds are dying of starvation, thirst, and disease. It must be so. If there ever is a time of plenty, this very fact will automatically lead to an increase in the population until the natural state of starvation and misery is restored. In a universe of electrons and selfish genes, blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt, other people are going to get lucky, and you won't find any rhyme or reason in it, nor any justice. The universe that we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is, at bottom, no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but pitiless indifference." That is a worldview of hopelessness. And I want you to understand today that that is not the message of the Bible. And that's not the message of the book of Lamentations. I invite you to consider the message of hope from Lamentations this afternoon. Lamentations consists of five poems of lament. Now, these poems were originally written in Hebrew. And I don't know as much as I should about Hebrew poetry, but the more I learn about it, the more fascinating that it is. Hebrew poetry differs from what we know as poetry in English. For one thing, in English, we're used to poetry having rhyme and meter. And Hebrew poetry doesn't really rely on rhyme and meter. In fact, what little of Hebrew I do know, you see that because of the various endings, most words in Hebrew rhyme, or at least a lot of them do. There's not really a lot of challenge in that. Hebrew poetry uses different aspects, such as aspects of structure, the way that things are arranged, the place that it appears in the order, and devices like repetition. The poems in Lamentations are mainly acrostics, and that's why that you have 22 verses in each of the chapters, 1, 2, and 4. That's because there are 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet, and each verse starts with a different letter in succession through the alphabet. So it would be just like us composing a line that would begin with A, and then one with B, and then one with C, and so on until we got to Z. Chapter 5 of Lamentations is not an acrostic. Each verse doesn't begin with a different Hebrew letter, but it does also have 22 verses maintaining that structure. But you'll notice in chapter 3 that it's different. In fact, in chapter 3, instead of one verse starting with a letter of the alphabet, three verses start with a letter of the alphabet before moving on to the next. So you have three verses that start with Aleph before you go on to Bet and on all the way through the Hebrew alphabet. Acrostics were helpful for memorizing. In other words, we do that. We refer to it as mnemonics. We will assign a letter, and we'll memorize things that way. Those that learn musical notation, you know every good boy does fine. And if somebody tries to teach you differently than that, it's heresy. You know, it's every good boy does fine. Some people want to get clever and they want to come up with their own little sentence, but no, this is holy writ that's established. Acrostics are helpful for memorizing. See, I still remember that. I was taught that in, I don't know what it was, sixth grade or something in music class in school, and I still remember that. Acrostics also express a fullness or a completion. It's like us saying everything from A to Z. Everything from A to Z. In other words, we're covering everything. The triple acrostic in Lamentation 3 also achieves emphasis through repetition because you have the repeating of three lines with each one letter and then going to the next, so you have the 66 verses. A structural aspect of Hebrew poetry is also the use of chiasm. And that mainly just refers to a shape. It's just a way of ordering things, of ordering lines or verses, or in the case of Lamentations, the chapters, in a certain order, in a certain shape. And what that shape accomplishes is that it gives emphasis to the middle. Typically in English poetry, we would also be used to that emphasis coming at the end. That's where we get our climax. That's where we get our resolve, if you will. But not that way, particularly in the chiastic structure in the Hebrew. So the five poems of Lamentations do indeed form a chiasm. 1 and 5, chapters 1 and 5, they parallel one another. Chapters 2 and 4 parallel one another. And that leaves chapter 3, which is in the middle. And it is the point of emphasis in the book of Lamentations. It is the message of hope. In the middle of this book, in chapter 3, is where we find the book to be most hopeful. The most positive aspect of message that you're going to get as you go through Lamentations is going to come from chapter 3. If we were looking at an outline of this chapter, verses 1 to 18, Jeremiah rehearses his afflictions. In fact, verses 1 to 18 are pretty grim when you look at them. But he remembers, when he comes to the end of that, he remembers after this that he does have hope. Look at verse 18. He said, "And I said, my strength and my hope is perished from the Lord." Verses 19 to 24, Jeremiah speaks of the fact that he has hope because of God's character. In verses 25 to 30, he essentially teaches the exiles and those that would follow after how to have hope in God in such a miserable time as what they were in. Verses 31 to 36 teaches that while God does afflict, and we noticed that in the previous message at how the book of Lamentations points out the fact that God has afflicted the people of Judah and He has reached out to destroy Jerusalem. He's taken up the Babylonians as an instrument in His hand and He has brought them down. But Jeremiah also teaches us here in verses 31 to 36 that God does not afflict for no reason. It's not arbitrary. It's not random. And it's not without purpose. It's by design. Verses 37 to 39, faithfulness to punish in God is also faithfulness to deliver. Verses 40 to 51, he exhorts the exiles to turn to the Lord because that is where their hope is truly found. And in verses 52 to 66, he turns all of his enemies over to God to leave that in His hands for justice, for vengeance, and for retribution. We're not going to be able to look at all of this chapter here, but we do want to look at this middle section of this chapter, beginning with verse 19. Verses 19 to 24 teach us that there is hope because of God's character, because of who He is. Verse 19, remembering mine affliction and my misery, the wormwood and the gall, my soul hath them still in remembrance and is humbled in me. This I recall to my mind, therefore have I hope. Understand that Jeremiah is in danger of giving in to despair due to outward afflictions and inward grief. He thought his strength and his hope were perished, as he said in verse number 18. If he took stock of his circumstances and all that he had experienced through those reforms of Josiah that seemed to be so hopeful, to now the place where Jerusalem lays in smoldering ruins and the people lie dead in the streets or else they have been carted off into Babylon. As rivers of waters run down from his eyes because of the grief of the daughter of his people, calling something to mind brought him hope. Not the circumstances, not the idea that they would be able to band together and accomplish something. He said, "This I recall to mind, and therefore have I hope." And he says this in verse 22, "It is of the Lord's mercies that we are not consumed, because his compassions fail not." They were afflicted and they were grieved. But you know what? They were still there. Judah was not destroyed. There was a remnant that was preserved out of that devastation. They were still alive. We talked about how in chapter 4 and verse number 6, how that the punishment of their iniquity seems so much greater than Sodom, because Sodom was destroyed and wiped out in an instant. And rather, they're having the experience of God's hand being heavy upon them, and it still is. But this is why the judgment on Sodom is not preferable. That was a judgment of destruction. And what came upon Judah was a punishment for their sins. By God's design, they're still here. Jeremiah says, we're not consumed. Now, are they not consumed because of any goodness in themselves? No, he says, it's because of the Lord's mercies that we are not consumed. As severe as the punishment had been, they were not totally destroyed, and it was by the Lord's mercies. And yes, that is the Hebrew word chesed. It is a word that, as far as I can tell, really defies a single English language word translation. Sometimes it's translated as kindness, sometimes as mercy, sometimes as loving kindness. Sometimes I've seen the word has been translated as steadfast love. It is a word that is associated with God's covenantal love and loyalty. So what Jeremiah gives expression to here in these verses in chapter 3 is covenantal language. He's saying because of God's covenant love that He has promised and purposed in Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and down through the generations, because of that covenant love, we have not been consumed or totally destroyed. We're still here because of God's covenant love. Not because their sins didn't deserve such a destruction. Their sins deserved such a destruction. But it's because of God's loving kindness they have been preserved. In fact, he goes on to speak of them and say in verse 23, they are new every morning. Great is thy faithfulness. The promises to Abraham and God's mercy through those promises to the seed of Abraham are renewed every single morning. We awake, and God's promises are still there. Jerusalem is destroyed, but God's promises are still there. How many of the house of Judah are lying dead in the streets of Jerusalem, even as he writes this, but yet we are still here. We have life. We have breath. And it's because of the covenant mercies of God and the promise that he made to Abraham when he called him and brought him out from that pagan land and said, I will bless you. And I will make your name great. And I will make of you a great nation. And in you and in your seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed. And God intends to keep his promises. That's where Jeremiah is finding hope in this time. Not that maybe God will overlook them. Not that maybe God will let it slide. But he knows that there's hope of a restoration for the people because of God's faithfulness to his promises. But think about this also. If they are not consumed, and those mercies are renewed every morning, then that means that God is willing to restore. God is just as he has been described so many times in the pages before Lamentations, that he is a God of mercy, that he's a God of grace. He is a God with whom there is forgiveness. He is a God who will abundantly pardon. He's a God who delights in mercy. The promised curses of Leviticus chapter 26 and Deuteronomy chapter 28 and 29 had come upon the people because of their disobedience. They had been warned for nearly a millennium. But if you turn over to the next chapter, Deuteronomy chapter 30, not only were there promises of curses coming upon them and judgments coming upon them for disobedience, there's also an expression of God's purpose and willingness to restore. Verse 1 of chapter 30 says, And it shall come to pass, when all these things are come upon thee, the blessing and the curse which I have set before thee, for thou shalt call them to mind among all the nations whither the Lord thy God hath driven thee, and shalt return unto the Lord thy God, and shalt obey his voice according to all that I command thee this day, thou and thy children with all thine heart and with all thy soul, that then the Lord thy God will turn thy captivity and have compassion upon thee and will return and gather thee from all the nations whither the Lord thy God hath scattered thee. After the pronouncement of all of this devastation because of their rebellion and because of their disobedience, God says, But yet after that time has come, I will turn your captivity. I will turn and have compassion upon you. I will turn and will gather you out of all the nations that you have been scattered to. And I will return you to the land that I have promised to your fathers. That's the kind of promise that Jeremiah is finding hope in amidst all of the ruin that he sees around him. And the fact that God had punished, the fact that it meant that God had kept his word. He had promised them that he would do this. He had sent them messenger after messenger warning them that if they did not repent and they did not turn, he would do this. And he did it. He did it. He kept his word. He was faithful to his promise to punish his people in this way. But Jeremiah is also looking at this from the other side. That means that God is faithful. And if he has manifested his faithfulness in punishing his people to their ruin and their scattering among the nations, then he will also be faithful to his promises to gather and to restore them. Jeremiah and Ezekiel prophesied the devastation of Jerusalem, and both of them lived to see it, to see that prophecy, though Ezekiel was not in Jerusalem when it happened. But both Ezekiel and Jeremiah also prophesied about a new covenant that God would make with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. Both Jeremiah and Ezekiel prophesied of a new spirit that would be put within the people of Judah. Not like the old spirit that was in them and the old covenant that they were under that they could never keep. They could never bring the blessings of Abraham to fruition through that old covenant. But God says, I will make a new covenant with you. And there will be a new spirit that will be put within you. And there will be a new heart that will be put within you. That old heart of flesh and stone will be taken out, and a new heart will be put within you. Judah and Israel would be cleansed through this new covenant. They would be gathered through this new covenant. You know what else? They would be united together under one king through this new covenant in the very land that was promised unto Abraham. Jeremiah chapter 31, verses 31 to 34. Ezekiel chapter 36, verses 26 to 27. These are the places where Jeremiah found hope in the midst of ruin, the hope of restoration. Look at the next section, beginning with verse 25. Verse 25 says, "The Lord is good unto them that wait for Him, to the soul that seeketh Him. It's good that a man should both hope and quietly wait for the salvation of the Lord." Though Jeremiah was out of Jerusalem and all he saw there was devastation, he knew that God's promises would not fail. And that meant that he should hope and quietly wait for God's salvation. Jeremiah is instructing the exiles, and oh, that they would hear it even today, that you must wait and you must hope in that salvation that is to come with the return of your Messiah. Yes, that's the message of hope. And that is what Jeremiah is instructing the exiles. This is where you have hope. You're out of your land. The land is gone. The temple is gone. The priests are gone. There's no more sacrifice. There's no more feast. There's no more observances. There's no more morning and evening prayers. All of these things are gone. Where is your hope going to be placed? I believe that Jeremiah is indicating to them that it's not to be placed in the rebuilding of Jerusalem. Oh, that will happen, but that's not where their hope is to be placed. Much like the writer of Hebrews wrote to those Jews in his day, your hope is not in a return to the shadow of the temple. No, that's not your hope. Your hope is in turning fully to Jesus Christ and going to Him without the camp and suffering that reproach. In other words, you have to leave that old covenant. You have to leave that old covenant behind. You will not be reconciled to God. Your salvation will not come that way. You have to go to Christ in the new covenant, the mediator of a better covenant and a better testament, the better high priest, the better temple, the better sacrifice. I believe that Jeremiah is echoing that very same message. You're going to have to hope and quietly wait for the salvation of the Lord. Notice as he goes on, he says, "It's good for a man that he bear the yoke in his youth. He sitteth alone and keepeth silence because he hath borne it upon him. He putteth his mouth in the dust, if so be that there may be hope." He speaks of bearing patiently in those afflictions. These are obviously the effects, the consequences of national sins of Judah and Israel, as well as the consequences of their personal sins. He says, you're going to have to bear those afflictions. And he says, it's even good. It's even good that you bear those afflictions. And that is explained when you go on reading. Verses 31 to 36. For the Lord will not cast off forever. But though he cause grief, yet will he have compassion according to the multitude of his mercies. For he doth not afflict willingly, nor grieve the children of men, to crush under his feet all the prisoners of the earth, to turn aside the right of a man before the face of the Most High, to subvert a man in his cause, the Lord approveth not. What is Jeremiah saying? Jeremiah is saying, it's good to bear up under your afflictions, because these are the afflictions of the Lord. And he is telling them here that God afflicts only by design. God doesn't afflict willingly. In other words, God does not afflict as an end in itself. God does not delight in pain and misery. God doesn't delight in afflictions. He tells us in verse 31 and 32 that these afflictions are only temporary and they're not without love. We've all learned that lesson, having a father to discipline us. And they did it imperfectly. They did it sometimes out of their own selfish motives. And God help us today as we struggle against those things. Am I just disciplining you because I'm upset? Because I'm angry? Because you've inconvenienced or you've embarrassed me? Or am I disciplining you because it's for your good? Well, the writer of Hebrews tells us in Hebrews chapter number 12, verses 5 to 17, that God's afflictions are always designed for our good. He admits that they're grievous. No one enjoys it. It's not an enjoyable process. But they're always for our good. God's afflictions are such that we have to bear patiently, having that knowledge. Then we come to the next part. Verse 37 to 39, who is he that saith, and it cometh to pass, when the Lord commandeth it not? Out of the mouth of the Most High proceedeth not evil and good. Wherefore doth a living man complain, a man for the punishment of his sins? God punished Judah according to his promise to do so. But that meant that God is faithful to his promises. I didn't used to understand when my own dad would tell me that this hurts me more than it hurts you. Dad, that can't be possible. I didn't really understand as a young child when he said, I'm doing this because I love you. I understand that more now. But that, how much more is that the case with a loving and faithful Father in heaven? He loves them too much to allow them to continue in sin without punishment, such that they would be destroyed from off the face of the earth. He brings that discipline to them. But that also means that God's faithful to his promises. If he kept his promise to punish, then he will also keep his promise to restore. Look around you. We're in Babylon. Jerusalem has fallen and lies in ruins. God promised that he would do this, and he's faithful. Praise the Lord. And everybody's like, well, what's wrong with that guy? But he's right. Don't you realize that this means God was faithful to his promises to bring punishment? That means he will be faithful to his promises to bring restoration. And that is hopeful. And that is helpful. The afflictions, no matter how severe and how grievous that they were to be borne, they had a purpose. And they also had an end. And they also had a better day that is yet to come. I believe that Jeremiah would teach us even that our afflictions should turn us to God. That's what he says in verse 40. He says, let us search and try our ways and turn again to the Lord. Let us lift up our heart with our hands unto God in the heavens. Yes, our afflictions should turn us to God. We should recognize that we have nowhere to turn. What does an exiled Jew in Babylon have to turn to? There's no temple. There's no sacrifice. There's no offering. There's no feast. There's no Jerusalem. The city of David, the city of God, Zion, beautiful for situation, lies in ruins. There's nowhere else to go but to go to God. Have you ever found that true in your own afflictions? Have you received the strokes that have seemed to cut you off from all human help? Our afflictions should cause us to recognize we have nowhere to turn. We have nowhere to hope. We have nowhere to trust but in God. But we should also recognize that still having life means that we have received mercy. As we conclude this message, thinking of these verses 40 and 41 in particular, they give direction for the response to suffering. That's a message to Judah, but it's a message to us today as well. Search our ways. Turn to the Lord. And the note of hope is last sounded in this book when you turn over to chapter 5. In verse 19, Thou, O Lord, remainest forever. Thy throne from generation to generation. Wherefore dost Thou forget us forever and forsake us so long time? Turn Thou us unto Thee, O Lord, and we shall be turned. Renew our days as of old. But Thou hast utterly rejected us, and Thou art very wroth against us. The message for Israel in Lamentations is that their only hope is in the coming of the Messiah. You see, not only have they been promised that if they kept the Word of God, they would dwell in blessing, and if they rejected the Word of God, they would inherit curses. Not only have they been promised that, but they've been promised a seed of the woman that would come to crush the serpent's head. They've been promised a seed of Abraham that would come and through which all families of the earth would be blessed. They've been promised a star out of Jacob. They've been promised a scepter out of Judah, a lion of the tribe of Judah. They've been promised a prophet greater than Moses who would come. And they have been promised a better David. David had a failed attempt after he had captured the city of Jerusalem. And it was after that known as the city of David. And all of the wonderful things began to be sung and to be believed and hoped in about this great city of Zion that David had captured. But do you realize that he had a failed attempt at purifying Zion? At one point he declared a ban. There would not enter into this city any that are blind or lame or deaf or dumb. The deformed and the handicapped and the diseased will be barred from entering into this city. And that's a place where David the type becomes David the antitype. Because you realize David tried to purify and beautify and glorify the city of Zion by eliminating all of those with deformity. The greater David will come, and he will not put a ban upon any entering that city. But do you realize there will be no blind or lame or halt or maimed or deaf or dumb in that city? But not because he has put a ban upon them entering, but because he has healed them. Because he has made them whole. You see, that is where their hope is. Their hope is in a coming Messiah who will destroy their enemies. Here in Lamentations 3, verses 59 and 64 and 66. They need one to destroy their enemies. chapter 4 and verse number 22 in Lamentations. They need one to bring an end to their judgment. And here in chapter 5 and verse 21, they need one to restore them to God. Their hope is in God's promise to when the time of His wrath is past. That's what they've got to look to. Yes, that veil is still on their hearts, as we heard preached earlier. Yes, that blindness is still upon them to this day. Yes, the hand of God is still heavy upon them to this day. They have to look to the time when God's wrath is past. Isaiah chapter 40 and verse 2. They have to look to the time, according to the prophet Isaiah, written over 100 years before the book of Lamentations. They have to look to a time when the one who scattered will also gather. Chapter 40, verses 9 to 11. They're not to look to the temple, but they are to wait on the Lord. Verses 27 to 31 in Isaiah 40 as well. There is coming a day, in fact, when Israel will understand in all their lamentations how that Jesus Christ, the seed of the woman, the seed of Abraham, the son of David, how that He entered into their lamentations and bore them Himself. You notice Jeremiah's language of giving the cheeks to the smiters, being brought down to the dust, weeping over the city of Jerusalem. And even this expression, verse 20 of chapter 5. Wherefore dost thou forget us forever and forsake us so long time? Do you realize how much that Jesus Christ entered into their lamentations? That from the very cross of His death, He cried out the words of the psalmist in Psalm 22:1, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? You see, Isaiah wrote in Isaiah chapter 63 and verse 9, in all their affliction, He was afflicted. And the angel of His presence saved them. In His love and in His pity, He redeemed them. And He bare them and carried them all the days of old. In all their afflictions, He was afflicted. The Lord Jesus Christ endured these lamentations on behalf of His people. Isaiah also prophesied in chapter 53 that future confession of Israel when they embrace their Messiah, and they will acknowledge this in verses 3 and 4. He is despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and we hid, as it were, our faces from Him. He was despised, and we esteemed Him not. Surely He hath borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we did esteem Him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. Not only did Jesus bear the sins of His people, but even their sorrows and their griefs, and in all their afflictions, He was afflicted. But this message is not to Israel only. It is to all who will call upon the name of the Lord. There is no pitiless indifference in heaven, because as the book of Lamentations tells us, God is in heaven. Chapter 3 and verse 41. Let us lift up our heart with our hands unto God in the heavens. Verse number 50. Till the Lord look down and behold from heaven. And verse 66. Persecute and destroy them in anger from under the heavens of the Lord. There's no pitiless indifference in heaven. There's not above us only sky. that looks upon our afflictions and doesn't care. No, there's a loving and faithful Father who sees and knows, and He sent His Son from heaven to enter into our lamentations and to redeem our griefs and to one day wipe away all tears from the eyes of all those who trust in Him. All right, I'm finished.